Who's that I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
From Little Red Riding Hood to Hansel and Gretel, and thousands more stories, some familiar, some not, we'll talk about fairy tales this hour. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in this week for Kathleen Dunn. It's 7 minutes after 10 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour is Jack Zipes, Professor Emeritus of German and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota. He's been studying fairy tales since once upon a time, let's say. He's written a lot of books on the topic. His newest is The Irresistible Fairy Tale, The Cultural and Social History of a Genre. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Glad you could join us. Before we get to fairy tales in particular, why do humans tell stories in general?
There are many debates about that. But I think, based on the research that I've done, the most important thing about telling stories is information that people began spreading information or giving information or providing information in families, in clans, in tribes, going back 200,000 or so years. Of course, we don't have records about that, but the assumption is that speech evolved because of the necessity to cooperate with one another within environments that were possibly hostile to the people who were living in these environments, and they needed very much to share information that eventually turned into stories of various kinds in order to survive, to adapt to the environment.
So if I can oversimplify dramatically, we're in some senses wired to want to tell and hear stories.
Yes, a lot of evolutionary anthropologists, biologists, psychologists, and so on have recently agreed, more or less, that this is the case, that there is something that we are disposed through speech and also through other means to communicate with one another in order to have the best possible lives, that is, to adapt to our environments in the best way we can so that we can be comfortable.
That's storytelling in general. How do we define a fairy tale relative to other kinds of stories that are out there?
It's very difficult to do that because almost all the short forms of storytelling that include myths, legends, anecdotes, family tales, fairy tales, and so on and so forth, are hybrid forms. That is, that they are related to one another, they borrow from one another, and they also, to a certain extent, distinguish themselves from one another. For instance, the distinction, or what we mean by fairy tale, really happened only in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. In other words, before that, people just told tales, and they didn't say, well, I'm about to tell you a religious tale, or I'm about to tell you an animal tale, and so on and so forth. They just told the tales that suited the, let's say, situation or the context. But there were distinctions. Distinctions could be made, and as we developed as rational human beings and began to rationalize our lives, we wanted to categorize tales for certain occasions, and fairy tales, to a certain extent, are distinguished by the fact that, one, they're secular. There's nothing religious about them, although sometimes references to a particular religion will creep in. Secondly, every fairy tale generally has some type of magical or miraculous transformation that enables the protagonist to attain what he or she wants or wishes or desires. And the third, I think, a really important distinction is that, unlike our real world, there is some type of social justice in fairy tales. That is, the bad people, the villains, the wicked people, generally are punished, and there is some type of social justice that is attained at the end of a fairy tale. So that the fairy tales, to a great extent, are counter-worlds, counter-moral worlds, I would say, without being didactic, to the real worlds in which people live. That, and one of the reasons I think that we tell fairy tales and love fairy tales is because that which we cannot attain in the real world actually occurs in fairy tale worlds. And therefore, we continue to tell these tales in all spheres of life, and we develop them, create them in many, many different ways in order to a certain extent critique what is lacking in our personal lives and also in the real world.
I know it's hard to trace the earliest origins of fairy tales, their ancestors anyway, because they weren't necessarily written down, and we can't go back and listen. But do you get the sense that with that idea of a social justice that people couldn't attain in the real world, that this was particularly popular among, say, people at the lowest end of the spectrum, the peasant villager, the person at the bottom rung of town or city life in the late medieval Renaissance era?
Yes, I think so. But, a famous folklorist who was a friend of mine, probably one of the great folklorists of the 20th century, Alan Dundees, once said at a lecture that I attended, he looked at this white middle class audience, and he started talking about the folk, and he looked at everybody in the audience. I don't know what social classes they were from, but they were generally probably more affluent than the sort of peasants or lower classes, and he said, "We are the folk," and he said, "The folk is us," mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, I think he really struck a chord that resonates, at least with me. These tales were told by both upper-class people and lower-class people. And we must remember that, upper-class people were also not satisfied with the world and with the rules and regulations and laws. For instance, the rise of the literary fairy tale was in the 1690s in France, in Paris, when King Louis XIV was king, and he was a tyrant and decadent and started many wars, he was devastating the country and so on. And also women had very little power. Well, in the 1690s, French aristocratic women who had heard tales from their nannies and so on, and had also read other books of fairy tales, mainly from Italy, they began writing these amazing fairy tales that one could say they're proto-feminist, and to a great extent critique the type of society in the Ancien Régime that was really unsatisfactory as far as they were concerned. So this is not to say that, all writers of the upper classes, wrote fairy tales like that, but there's a tradition, even in the literary tradition, where educated writers of the upper classes wrote tales and continue to write tales even today, that they use that particular form to a great extent metaphorically to say something critical about society.
That's Jack Zipes talking about fairy tales. He's the author of books including The Enchanted Screen and The Irresistible Fairy Tale. We'll get to more modern incarnations of fairy tales in a bit. We're working through the history, but I'm interested in hearing your thoughts. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Is there a fairy tale you loved hearing as a kid that you love telling as a grown-up? A favorite incarnation of fairy tales on the big screen? 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Jack Zipes, there was a very conscious effort to start collecting these fairy tales. I think a lot of it in the 19th century, the Brothers Grimm, just the most famous of them. Why did people set out to start collecting these fairy tales?
Yeah, that movement, I won't say that it was initiated by the Brothers Grimm, but they were the, I think, pioneers to a great extent, was extremely important because I think that with the rise of the educated classes, middle classes, and the development of universities and schools, more and more educated people began realizing that that language and the culture of the simple people, the agrarian population, was dying, and a lot of the tales and a lot of their customs and rituals were slowly disappearing, and they began to take an interest for the, I would say, for the first time to a certain extent. In other words, there was a mass movement across Europe, and which spread also to the United States, or what was the United States at that time. And they decided to really pay attention to what the tales, what the culture of the of simple people were of all classes, and began doing research. A lot of them going, you know, into the countryside. The Grimms, by the way, never did, or they did to a very minor extent, but throughout the 19th century, throughout Europe, and then later on in America, people began collecting these oral tales before they evaporated. This had not been done, you know, in the Renaissance period or the medieval period, or if it had been done, it had been done very, very rarely. So it's just amazing. By the end of the 19th century, composing or creating an anthology of 19th century folk oral tales, and there were literally hundreds of anthologies or collections that were created by extremely gifted folklorists. They didn't call themselves folklorists at that time, but by the end of the century, they started doing that, and they have preserved amazing amount of tales. And they have long introductions to their books or notes about the customs and rituals of the people, and it is just fascinating. And even today, we don't, or we're starting to forget to pay attention to this type of culture.
And I always wonder, these fairy tales were handed down. They're probably different from country to country, village to village, maybe even between neighbors.
Yes.
How did writing them down change the fairy tale?
Yeah, well, first of all, the writing down had to be in dialect if it was going to be, let's say, true to the word. And at the beginning of the 19th century and through the middle of the 19th century, many collectors, most collectors, immediately translated. They knew dialects very well. And so they wrote the tales down in High German or High French and High Italian, High Russian, whatever. But by the middle of the 19th century, many, many collectors began writing them down first in dialect, as best they could, and then later on translating them into sort of the standard language of their country. I have tended to say that most collectors or most collections, even though they say they're directly from the mouths of the people, that was current in the titles of the books, they're really not, because they were always translations into the standard language. Nevertheless, they're very close to the originals. For instance, I can tell you from firsthand experience, I translated dialect Sicilian tales by Giuseppe Pitre, who collected them in the 1870s in Sicily. And I had to learn the Sicilian dialect, not to speak it, but to read it. And I also seen translations of the dialect into Italian. And the translations into Italian tend to be very good. But my own translations were into English. And so you really lose that flavor of the dialect because I was not going to translate them into American slang. That would be almost an impossible task. But it is important, I think, for people like myself or other translators who are translating folk tales to try to look at the dialect tales, if there are any, before they do their translation.
That's Jack Zipes, professor of German and comparative literature at the University of Minnesota. We are talking about fairy tales this hour. The appeal of fairy tales, how they change over time. We've got some full lines. We'll get to your calls coming up. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Clan MacGuffin!
MacGuffin!
The cauldron! With one moldy potato, this magical cauldron fed the entire clan MacGuffin.
Oh, cookery!
Giving us the strength to slay 10,000 Macintosh in battle.
Beware the power of the cauldron!
A clip from the Pixar movie Brave, one of the most recent in a long line of fairy tale movies. Rob Ferret here filling in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking about fairy tales with Jack Zipes, professor emeritus of German and comparative literature, author of books including The Irresistible Fairy Tale. Before we go to the phones, Jack Zipes, how did cinema change the fairy tale as we see it?
Oh, the changes have been astounding. They began actually in the late 1890s with Georges Méliès, a French director who was absolutely brilliant and original, unique. And he was the first to adapt fairy tales in 4 to 8 minute or 12 minute films in a black and white using a stationary camera. And basically, he quite often adapted the stories. For instance, his version of Bluebeard turns out to be a farce, in which Bluebeard is made into a type of a fop who is eventually killed at the end. It's hilarious to watch. And he did about 15 or 20. A lot of his films were burned in the 20th century. He began, I would say, the interest in fairy tales that led to an amazing amount of silent black and white films at the beginning of the 20th century, and it led also to animation with Walt Disney was one of the first to adapt fairy tales into black and white in the actually early 1920s, way before Snow White in 1937. But by the 1930s, with the use of sound, color, studios, outside shooting, and there were live action, amazing amount of live action films. In fact, people don't realize, but practically every year since the beginning of the 20th century, there have been 20 or 30 or 40 fairy tale films made throughout the world every year. And it's getting even larger. Fairy tale films have the advantage of fleshing out characters, using special effects, color, being very inventive, being able to change a story any way they want to. And to a certain extent, it imposes its images on us more so than when we read or hear the tales. Because to a certain extent, when we read or listen to a tale, let's say a Grimm's fairy tale or a Charles Perrault or Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, we can create the images ourselves, and we're more, let us say, autonomous in terms of the way we use our imagination to picture what the scene may be like. So films, to a certain extent, one could almost say imperialistic. They rule us while we're watching the film. Of course, we can still use our imaginations, but to a certain extent, films really take away, to a certain extent, our ability, or let us say our choice, to picture these characters in different ways.
So the film becomes, say, the Disney movie becomes the defining version of that tale in a lot of our minds.
Yes, yes. In fact, one could say that Disney, the Disney Corporation, has, to a certain extent, replaced or effaced the Grimm Brothers and Charles Perrault and Anderson. What they have dominated the market in the or let's say the film industry in the 20th century, and it's only in the late part of the 20th century and beginning of the 21st century that other studios have been fighting back and trying to grab a piece of the fairy tale, let's say, audience.
Well, that takes us to a point of our first caller. Rich in Rhinelander has been waiting. Hi, Rich.
Hi. For me, fairy tales were a sort of counter-religious experience because they taught me when I was a little boy that setting aside our individual understandings to unite with some kind of a larger experience in the world didn't mean that we were sacrificing our individuality, but we were in some way or another getting a gift, because a story is really a gift that reveals something to us about what it means to live in a community of human beings. And two films I saw recently, I see an awful lot of movies, which may say something about the emptiness of my late life. One, just the other night, as a matter of fact, it was Snow White and the Huntsman, which I found absolutely brilliant. The Snow White that was just spoken of, Walt Disney's version in 1937. 1937 was also the year Mark Blitzstein produced under the Federal Theater Project, The Cradle Shall Rock, about Mr., the boss, and the counter character, the foreman, who was the union organizer type. The other film that I saw was Ted, about a teddy bear that comes to life and is a dirty, talking, sex-crazed, sort of just a terrible influence on the main character played by Mark Wahlberg, who cannot commit to the woman who is sort of clueless about who she's hanging out with, and puts up with just an awful lot of adolescent behavior late into their four-year relationship. And I wanted to ask your guests, first of all, about a very good program. Secondly, I want to ask your guest, don't we need fairy tales today in this age about gun ownership and responsibilities and things that bring us together as a community?
Gotcha. Well, Rich, a lot we can attack there. Let's start with modern fairy tale movies. I know that's an issue you track, Jack Zipes.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on the movies that that Rich mentioned, or what you're seeing in general in movie fairy tales?
Right. Well, I think Rich has hit on something very significant, and this notion of community cooperation that is very common in folk tales and fairy tales of the past, and still to a certain extent is with us. For instance, I'm very interested in I've been writing about this fairy tale that the Brothers Grimm wrote called How Six Made Their Way Through the World. It's about a discharged soldier talking about the relation to contemporary society. It's about a discharged soldier who's poorly treated by the king and then wants to get revenge because he served the king loyally. It's sort of, you could draw a parallel with the way we treat our veterans in America today. And he eventually finds five, what I would call superheroes, somebody who can hit a fly about 5 miles down the line, somebody who can carry a forest on his shoulders, and so on and so forth. And I mention this tale because of the fact that one of the film or series of films that have to do with superheroes, like recently the Avengers, or you can, you know, the Fantastic Four, and there are all sorts of films about superheroes joining together, the X-Men, who bring about some type of justice in the world. So to a certain extent, fairy tales creep into a lot of our comics, of popular films, without our realizing that they hawk, that these films really are based on folk and fairy tales of the 19th century, and they do deal with the notion that we need to cooperate, we need to develop communities that have social justice, so that the violence that is perpetuated throughout the society can be done away with, that we can create a society in which people are treated fairly and kindly. I have certain doubts about, you know, the recent films like Mirror Mirror, Brave, and also Snow White and the Huntsman, because I do appreciate the fact that they present strong women, protagonists, but they tend to be somewhat elitist because it's always a princess who champions or leads the way. It's not the community itself who can be strong enough to determine the way it wants to create laws and rules and so on and so forth. And also, these women who are become stronger, more like men than, let us say, women who are kind and passionate. In other words, why do we have to use violence against another woman? In almost all of these films, the conflict is between women, as though women created the evil in the world, that the wicked queen, the wicked person is always tends to be an older woman. So though I appreciate the fact that there are strong young women now in these films, I also have certain misgivings.
Rob Ferret here talking to Jack Zipes about fairy tales. Next on the line is Kay in Madison. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Well, you just kind of touched on what I was going to talk about. That
good.
I remember as a child that it was always the young girl trying to cope maybe with the Wicked Witch or the Evil Queen, or and I was just thinking that maybe it's because I thought my mother was mean or something that I remember those fairy tales more than others. But I don't see as much of that now. Of course, I don't go to the movies that you just mentioned. But I wondered what role feminism has played in the way that women are depicted. And I know that stepmothers always felt that they got a bad rap in fairy tales.
Jack Zipes?
Yes. I think there's been a change. There is another film by a French director, female director, Catherine Breillat, who did about 3 years ago, A Bluebeard. There's also a film called Mermaid that was done in Russia by a director by the name of Malekian, from a woman's point of view, protagonists tend to be much more active in trying to determine their destiny. In the Russian film, she actually unfortunately dies, but it does present the problems that women still have in a male-dominated society. So there are more and more films like this, and to a certain extent, I would say the active protagonist females in the films I mentioned, even though I have misgivings about them, represent a struggle that women still have. And there's no doubt that stepmothers, unfortunately, have been given a bad rap. And I think that filmmakers should think twice before they want to continue to perpetuate a sort of a lie or myth about stepmothers. There are a lot of stereotypes in these films, and also in the recent, there are two TV series. One is called Once Upon a Time, which is, I think, atrocious and terrible, and the other is called Grimm, which is much more comical. And in both of these TV series, which have been renewed for next year, I don't know why, these stereotypes are going to be, again, spread. That's all they work with in Hollywood, unfortunately. But there are many, many other fairy tale films that are being made today that contest the way both male stereotypes and female stereotypes have been created.
Thanks for the call, Kay. And Martin now is with us from West Allis. Hi, Martin.
Hello?
You're on the air, Martin.
Oh, hi. I really appreciate this topic, and thanks for taking my call. And a couple of callers ago, your guest had almost made a perfect segue. I was calling in reference to a more of a modern look at fairy tales. It's a comic book published by DC Comics in the Vertigo imprint, written by the excellent Bill Willingham, has won many awards called Fables.
Yes, and, yes, I know it.
Oh, you know it. Oh, well, then I don't have to explain it.
Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead, sorry.
Martin, go ahead. What is Fables?
Well, Fables basically is a it's kind of a look at all the fairy tales and fable creatures that we've read in all these stories throughout history are actually real, and they've been driven from their realms in their homelands by something they call the adversary, who's kind of taken a dictatorial overtake of their lands and driven them out, those that wouldn't comply to his rule. And they are living in a like kind of a secret borough called Fabletown in New York and kind of hidden from us Mundies. And kind of what their adventures are, partially with humanity, but among themselves, and kind of taking a look at, well, what if fables were really here in our world, having to deal with problems around them of their own and us? And it kind of progresses. It's been running for, since 2002. It's a very popular comic.
Sounds like fun. Thanks for bringing that up, Martin. Jack Zipes, you are familiar. Do you think you were not happy with the way TV was doing fairy tales? What about the comic industry?
I think there's also another, comic book series by Zeno, which I don't think is as good, but Fable is really excellent. I've read practically all the issues. I think it's still going on. I'm not too sure, but the TV the TV series Grimm, to a certain extent, is based on, or they stole the idea of for Grimm by bringing fairy tale characters into contemporary Portland, Oregon, not New York. And but they have created it's a buddy cop film where they typically, in order to meet political correctness, they have a white and black cop working together. And they try to, and the white cop is an ancestor of the Brothers Grimm, and he is he pursues all of these creatures that supposedly were in the Grimm's fairy tales. None of them were; they're made up by the screenplay writers. And every episode involves them pursuing a particular type of creature that is related to a Grimm fairy tale. But it's pat. It's very predictable. It's very formulaic, even though I'm amused by one particular character named Munro, who is an ex-werewolf, and he's trying to reform himself or has reformed himself.
Is he in a 12-step plan by any chance?
I think that would be a good idea. They should probably bring that into the series. But it's enjoyable, but it's fluff.
We're talking about fairy tales, past and present, with Jack Zipes. He's a professor emeritus of German and comparative literature at the University of Minnesota, author of The Enchanted Screen, The Irresistible Fairy Tale, and a lot of other books on the topic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Have a couple more great conversations lined up for tomorrow morning. After 9, the author of Red Ink, a look at the budget deficit, and it's a quick and fun read, believe it or not. Then after 10, we are going to talk about how we rate the American presidents, how historians stack them up, and how the voters of their time rated them. That's tomorrow, Wednesday, here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about fairy tales with Jack Zipes. He's written a lot on the subject. And we'll go back to the phones now with Mary in Harbor Spring. Hi, Mary.
Hi. This is a very interesting topic. I've had a lot of experience working with fairy tales, and I would be interested in your guest's comment on something. I know that a lot of people shy away from traditional fairy tales because of some of the stereotypes and the violence and things like that. But when fairy tales are told in a very calm way, not an unusually expressive way, but a very calm way to young children, they're allowed to create the images that they can handle, and it works in them from a sort of in a sort of archetypal way. Not, they don't think of it the way adults think of these things, and so I think it's very important that these tales continue to be told, and that the children not see films about them until they're older.
Interesting. I'm going to jump in. Jack Zipes, your response.
Let me first say that I've been a storyteller in schools, in elementary schools, for 40 years, and I actually have my experience as a storyteller has Wisconsin roots. I taught at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee for 14 years and actually began telling stories in elementary schools in Milwaukee many years ago. And here in Minneapolis, I developed a program of storytelling, which is now in about 20 schools in St. Paul and Minneapolis. It's a program called Building Bridges. And we work with every year for the entire school year. I've trained teaching artists to go into the schools to work with fairy tales, legends, myths, and different genres of stories. But when we tell tales with children, we try to tell, if we're using a 19th century tale by the Brothers Grimm or some other writer from the 19th century, we don't censor them. And in other words, at the end of Cinderella, for instance, the two stepsisters cut off their heel and their toe in order to try to get their feet into the slipper, and later on their eyes are pecked out by doves. That's one incident. And you know, there are incidents in the Grimm's tales that are somewhat gory or violent and so on. And we found, and I found as a storyteller, that it's very, very important that we not purposely introduce violence or gory details into the tales, but that we tell these tales in a way that children will listen and interpret them. You can't predict how they're going to interpret these tales or receive them, but that they see that this is, you know, the way life might be, and they themselves can try to work through and interpret these tales, and we speak with them and talk to them about their feelings after we tell these tales. We also introduce what we call counter tales that are a little more optimistic if the tale happens to be somewhat violent. And I think that one of the bad things that we do, one of the hypocritical things that we do with children, is we try to overly protect them when they can comprehend in their own way what is going on. Because many children, beginning with one or two or three, are brought up with violence, with conflict. They see it all around them. Even if they're exposed to television, they see these things. But the best thing about storytelling is that you're there with the children, and you can explain things, you can talk to them about it, they can express their feelings. And it's one of the unfortunate things in our society is that we don't have enough of this type of storytelling.
Thanks for the call, Mary. And that actually brings me to a point that I wanted to make sure we get to. Once upon a time, these fairy tales, or at least their ancestors, were an oral version only and not written. Now we read usually fairy tales, or we throw in a video or go to the movie to get it. Are we losing something by not handing down fairy tales orally and maybe putting our own twist on them and letting them change over time?
Yeah, I think so. I agree with you. I think that that's your point, that children, from what I've seen, are dying for this personal contact, really dying. I mean, when we go into the schoolroom, they every week, for the 2 hours that we're there, they are so attentive, are so enlivened, are really cherish the personal contact that a storyteller has with them. And it is a shame. I think we have lost this community feeling. Everything is through the media. Everything is mass mediated in some way. Parents don't have enough time in the evenings to tell stories or share stories, even personal stories with their children. Society has changed to such an extent that everything is technologically motivated and commercially motivated, so that the actual sharing of stories in a community is something that we lack and should try to find ways to, I think, restore to our society.
We'll go now to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Well, I just couldn't resist. I was thinking about the movie The Princess Bride, and I was wondering, you know, how fairy tale scholars would look at that. And because it, you know, it takes, in a way, it's a satire, but in another way, it's very, very sincere and takes all the elements of a fairy tale and does something new with it. You know, and has the villain is the handsome prince, mm-hmm. and then the witch is the witch helps save the hero's life.
As you wish, Sarah. Your thoughts on The Princess Bride, Jack
Zibes.
It's
a great film. I've seen it about 20 times. And it is a film of that is joyous. It plays with all the motifs, all the stereotypes in fairy tales. And it mocks the fairy tale, but creates a new fairy tale. And the setting is absolutely brilliant. You have a sick a child in bed, and his grandpa comes with a book. At first the boy says, "I hate fairy tales. Those are for girls, or you know, sissies, or whatever." And the grandfather says, "Yeah, I know." And then he begins telling this amazing sort of mock fairy tale that is very genuine. And it's all about love. It's all about overcoming evil. And it's all, and there is to a certain extent, it's a there is no, let us say, set happy ending. There's a happy ending as the three heroes ride off into the sunset. But we don't know whether they're going to be married. They're not rich, and so on. They break with royalty, and of course, the ultimate happy ending is that the boy wants to hear more stories. So it's a wonderful film.
It was a great moment for me watching that with my kids for the first time. Definitely. Thanks for bringing that up, Sarah. To Sadie now in Boscobel. Hi, Sadie. You're on the air.
Oh yeah. Earlier I heard about the Jack Zipes person, and in my brother's Grimm book, he wrote the introduction.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's your favorite fairy tale, Sadie?
I like the juniper tree a lot.
The what? Juniper tree?
Yeah, where the guy turns into a bird and he goes and gets stuff from different places by singing for people twice.
Ha. Thank you, Sadie, for calling in. Well, there's one young person you've reached there, Jack Zipes. The juniper tree, is that a favorite of yours too?
I wouldn't say it's a favorite. I'm surprised that she likes the fairy tale because it's very gruesome. It's about
well, maybe that's why.
It's about a tale in which the stepmother cuts off the head of a stepson, but he does come back. I think that Sadie likes his tale because he comes back to life and he gets revenge in the end, and he rises, so to speak, from death. And it's a powerful fairy tale. And Maurice Sendak, the great illustrator who unfortunately died this past year, he illustrated that tale, and it is a remarkable tale. It's a stunning tale.
Thanks for the call, Sadie. Want to get a couple more calls in before we're done? Virginia's been waiting in Milwaukee. Hi there, Virginia.
Oh, good morning. I'm so glad I got on here. I promised the young lady who took my call that I would make this short, and that is exactly what I'm going to do.
Go for it.
Now, I would like to ask your guest, Jack, what his ideas are on the moral of the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, which is The King's New Clothes.
All right, that was short. Jack Zipes.
Yes, I also love that tale. It's one of Andersen's best. I think it's superb. It's Andersen really disliked royalty. He had a hate-love affair with royalty in Denmark and throughout Europe, and in that tale, really, I think, is still contemporary. It exposes the hypocrisy of leaders, political leaders, and royalty throughout the world.
Thanks for the call, Virginia. Victor in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Victor.
Yes, I'll make mine just as quick. Couple of comments. One is you think of Western fairy tales, but here's one from Japan, and it was back in the 60s and 70s. This is The Seven Samurai, one of my favorite. And now you had the Western adaptation of a Western, literally, the Magnificent Seven.
Right.
So that was an interesting kind of translation of two fairy tales. As far as Walt Disney giving visuals, you know, it has its drawbacks. It takes away from the imagination, but I look at it as a wonderful introduction because I would have known none of these fairy tales exist if it wasn't for Walt Disney. So it has its positives.
Thanks, Victor. So your thoughts on Seven Samurai as
right.
a fairy tale?
God, you hit on two films that I love, and they go back, those two films go all the way back to Greek mythology, to the Argonautica, or the Jason and the Golden Fleece, who needs 50 Greek heroes in order to get the Golden Fleece. And it's also related to that story I mentioned before, how Six went out into the world. Both of these films, The Seven Samurai and The Magnificent Seven, stem, you know, from a long tradition, again, of superheroes altruistically getting together, cooperating to save a community, and they're definitely fairy tale like films. As far as Disney is concerned, I really, I'm sometimes overly critical of the films, but I think your caller is exactly right. I mean, to a certain extent, Disney at least, you know, brings back these tales to life, and whether we like them or dislike them, we at least have a chance to see them and then make up our minds.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I didn't want to leave without getting some homework from you, Jack Zipes. Can you leave us with a few fairy tales, maybe off the beaten path, that are worth reading, and then a film or two that we ought to go and check out?
Yes. Well, let me begin with films, because these are films that people generally don't see, but they can get them, you know, through Amazon or through other internet sources. They're in Russia today. There's an animator who is absolutely brilliant, and his name is Gary Bardin, Bardin, and he recently did An Ugly Duckling. I think you can actually see this on YouTube. That is absolutely brilliant. He's also done Red Riding Hood and the Grey Wolf, which is also a brilliant animated film. In France, there is a superb animator also. His name is Michel Ocelot, O-C-E-L-O-T, and he has done two wonderful films. One is called Kirikou and the Sorceress, and the other is called Kirikou and the Savages. Both of them are also available on DVDs. And the third one I would mention is Jiri Batak, who has done A Pied Piper, which is also absolutely brilliant. There are many other European filmmakers who have created fairy tale films, which I think are superb. I should also mention Tossum Sings the Fall, another film that I liked, a recent film, is How to Train Your Dragon, which I think is a wonderful film, an anti-war type of film. With regard to fairy tales, I would recommend, I think that I would just say to readers, explore the tales in the Brothers Grimm collections. I've translated the complete fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm, but there are other collections out there that I would recommend as well.
Jack Zipes, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
That was Jack Zipes, Professor Emeritus of German and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota, author of The Enchanted Screen and The Irresistible Fairy Tale. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing today's programs. Cynthia Schuster and Brittany DeAnda did a tag team operation on the phones today. Thanks to both of them. Thanks to you for listening and for your great calls and emails over the last couple of hours. Stick around. Larry Mueller's coming up. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.